Hello and welcome to Palace Confidential, your weekly look at all things royal, brought to you from the Mail's HQ in Kensington. I'm Jo Elvin and I'm joined by the Daily Mail's editor-at-large and veteran royal correspondent Richard Kaye and the Daily Mail's diary editor Richard Eden. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Two Richards are better than one. But let's start with an update on the royal right move, as we're calling it. And the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have confirmed that they will move to Adelaide Cottage on the Windsor estate and move their children to a new school. Richard Kaye, you wrote an interesting piece about this where you said they would be keeping the expensively refurbished Kensington Palace and Anne Hall. That's possibly not the best look at a time when the country's facing recession.
I think so. Timing's everything, and the royals are very sensitive to how they're perceived by the public, and it just looks slightly extravagant, slightly over the top. What's slightly surprising, in my view, about it is that William and Kate have been very good at sort of recognising, you know, public views on reading the rooms, and on this occasion, I felt they didn't.
Richard Eden, the Cambridges generally, as Richard says, managed to get things right when it comes to big PR moves, no pun intended, but have they misjudged this one?
Look, for me, life is more than public relations, and what's important is for them as a family, and this is a move that very much works for them. They're going to be living, you know, pretty close to the new school where all the children are starting together. And I think the public would understand that. They'd understand that he's putting family first. And they need to keep that Kensington Palace as their base. They have meetings there, you know, they meet dignitaries, they've got their offices. And yes, they have a holiday home too. But I think this idea of sort of going down the route of, oh, we're suffering, you know, we're poor too, it would never work. So I think it's better to be open about that. And yes, they've got three homes.
So what's going to happen to these two empty homes while they're living their best life?
Well, as Richard says, Kensington Palace remains their base. They've got a lot of office staff there. They'll still conduct meetings there and have all sorts of other functions there. It's also where their main entertaining is done. Anne Hall in Norfolk on the Sandringham estate is a much-loved retreat where they get away from it. They got away from it all during the summer. I imagine they'll still go up there for half term and holidays.
Can they Airbnb it?
Would
there be an opportunity for us to go and stay there?
Well, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. I think it's highly unlikely Anne would ever be on Airbnb, but some of the Queen's properties are.
You do which properties?
I can't say.
Oh, man, that's a revelation. We need to hear more about that. But returning to your piece, actually, for a minute, now I need to actually read my notes for this fascinating list at the end where you point out Prince Charles's homes, his four homes, Clarence House, Highgrove, Birk Hall in Scotland and a place in Wales, but then there's the Castle of May, where he likes to holiday, Dumfries House, which he saved for the nation, and a Romanian estate. Now, he's got all the Queen's properties that he will inherit on becoming king. So does he have some decisions to make there?
There could be a big audit when he becomes king.
I hope so.
He's going to have to work out what to do with all these properties. I mean, the one thing I will say is that the royals have always been very reluctant to dispose of properties once they've got them. He may well be future-proofing. He'll be thinking in terms of where his grandchildren are going to want to live. Why not keep the properties you've got now, even if you sort of mothball them for a few years? So when George, Louis and Charlotte are looking for their starter homes, they're already there.
Good old lucky old Louis and Charlotte. And back to the Cambridges for a minute, actually, Richard Eden. One reason for the move is George, Charlotte and Louis to go into the mixed Lambrook School in Buckinghamshire. That's a very different educational move from traditional royal households, isn't it?
It is in some ways. I mean, the biggest change is that it's a mixed school, as you say. Prince William went to single-sex schools. You know, he was in London at Wetherby, then Ludgrove in Berkshire, and then Eton, all of which were single-sex. So it's mixed, and that seems to be sort of following the route that Catherine did with her school. She went on to Marlborough College, which is a mixed boarding school. And the other key difference from the past is that all three children are going to be day pupils. They're going to be travelling back and forth to the home in Windsor. They're not going to be boarding, which William did from a very young age. And quite recently, actually, he spoke about how I wouldn't say traumatic, but how difficult that could be sometimes. He talks about travelling in the car with his mother and sort of playing Tina Turner songs, really. I think it was simply the best, really loud, to try and soothe their nerves ahead of the start of a term. So they're not going to have that. They're going to be day pupils. And so that's a big change.
Does that mean that the Duchess of Cambridge will be doing a twice daily school run?
Or William, yeah.
William, we think.
Fascinating.
William himself. One of the things he has said is that he has few memories of his father from his school days. His mother was very much in charge of it, and he wants to make sure that his three have a good memory of his role as a parent too.
I think that's lovely, actually. Let's move on. One person not afraid to do things her way is, as we know, the Duchess of Sussex, who this week launched her much-anticipated podcast. Archetypes or archetypes?
Archetypes.
Archetypes, thank you. And an interview with tennis star Serena Williams. Richard Eden, I know you've been listening. Do you have a review?
That was an hour of my life that I can never get back.
Well, guess what? They're all hours in your life you're not getting back, but I take the point.
How many? Yeah. I think there's 10 episodes or something to look forward to, shall I say. But anyway, look, I do the thing so that our viewers don't have to, and I listen to it all. And one of the things that came out of it for me was how good you are, Joe. You know, because...
Oh, stop it.
You know, you're there, you interview people, you let the guests speak.
Are you listening to Netflix and Spotify? I'll do it for half the money.
You know, it's fine to have me and Richard on, but, you know, Meghan had Serena Williams, you know, a global superstar. But we didn't hear much about Serena. It was all about Meghan. It was very much sort of, oh, well, that's enough about me. What do you think of me? And it was that whole kind of thing. So... instead of Serena making the headlines, all the headlines have been about Meghan's stories and the things she's disclosed during this podcast. And it was a missed opportunity, well, certainly for Serena. But I think given that, I'm not sure that famous people will really be queuing up to go on it, because they'll know that it's actually just all about the supposed interviewer.
Do you think that it's the British press would be more concerned with this headline about... Richard, I was going to ask you this suggestion on the podcast that the Sussexes had been forced to carry on to a work event after a fire had broken out in Archie's room.
Well, there obviously was a lot of... interest in that and a lot of headlines in the UK over it. The fire, was there a real fire or did something just overheat and was some smoke observed? I don't think any fire broke out from what we've heard from the palace. It didn't affect Archie. He wasn't in the room when it happened. He was elsewhere with his nanny. But Meghan seemed to be making the point that she shouldn't have been asked to continue with her royal engagements. Well, I kind of remember when William got clubbed over the head with a golf club and was rushed to hospital for surgery to a fractured skull. And Prince Charles carried on with his engagements. Yes, he went to check on his son at hospital, but knowing that everything was okay, he went back to hosting a very important evening engagement. So, you know, there is something about royals just carry on and doing things, but I think that she was over-dramatising this particular episode.
I think what really came across for me was that how Meghan sort of did misunderstand the royal family, and that came through so much, that this idea, you know, the royal family, you have to carry out your duties. It's not all about you, and this whole programme...
But maybe, putting aside whether or not that fire was a big deal or a little bit of smoke coming out of a heater, maybe there is a point in that sometimes family should trump duty. Maybe that is really hard for anyone outside the institution to understand.
Sure, but it sounds like it wasn't a particularly serious incident and no one was harmed. So it seemed natural not to let down the people. I mean, remember, look, this was a tour. They were touring some of the poorest areas of southern Africa. It was meant to be all about Africa, but this is the tour that, you know, Meghan sort of turned into being all about her. She gave that interview to Tom Bradby where no one ever asks, you know, how I'm doing. And it seemed to be that's what came across from the podcast. And also it was about ambition. That was the key word in the podcast, about how Meghan's ambitions had been sort of stifled in the royal family. But the royal family is not about personal ambition. It's about duty and about sacrifice.
Richard, could a member of the royal family opt out of of that kind of duty if they really wanted to?
Of course they could. Yeah. And you know, I'm sure it has happened over the years where a royal has had to pull out at the last minute because of some domestic event affecting their children, perhaps. But, you know, what what did Meghan and Harry know about what had actually happened? I think once they discovered that their son wasn't even in the room where the fire, smoke, whatever, was taking place, they must have been reassured. And if they weren't reassured, then of course, yes, they could have cancelled the engagement.
So, Richard, Eden, Harry made an appearance on the podcast too, I believe. Did that feel natural, or like a nice sort of bit of product placement of Team Sussex?
Well, we've seen him before sort of juggling in the window in a previous video call. But in this one, he just sort of turned up and I think was watching Serena on screen, because Meghan was interviewing her, I think, you know, via video. And he was just making some comments about her hair and how her hair was creating a good vibe, he said. Something like that. He was just trying to be friendly. But I think it did make the point that where is Harry? You know, when we heard the sort of teaser, when they did that teaser first episode of the podcast, the idea was clearly that they'd be interviewing people as a couple. Well, instead, we've got a whole series that Meghan's doing. Mm. You know, will Harry be doing one later on his own, or has he been sort of thrown overboard completely? I don't know.
What do you think?
I think we'll see Harry. I mean, certainly when his book comes out, if it comes out, I should think...
I'm really excited.
Well, we're all very excited, Jo. We're all very excited. But I should think he'll devote an entire podcast to that.
Yeah. I mean, in general, the royals need to maintain a broad appeal. And is this a reminder that Harry and Meghan now need to really bring in the numbers?
Well, it may well be for Spotify and their other digital investors who want to get their money's worth for all the bucks they've given them. But Harry and Meghan clearly feel they have to make these contributions from the other side of America to feel relevant, to be relevant, perhaps. I mean, they are competing with the usually footsure Cambridges who seem to go deftly about their royal routine without causing offence or making it all about them. Mm. Harry and Meghan seem to think the only way they can sort of be, to avoid being crowded out, is to make it just about them.
Let's move on now, and we are approaching the 25th anniversary of the death of Diana, the Princess of Wales. We thought we'd look at the often misunderstood relationship between the Princess and the Queen. Daily Mail columnist and royal biographer Robert Hardman gave us his thoughts.
The Queen is, her faith is incredibly important to her. She is she's a big tent kind of person. She's very forgiving. And, you know, she could see Diana was a wonderful mother to Harry and to William. And obviously with William in line to the throne, the Queen could see how important that relationship was. So it was, you know, a relationship that, like in any family, would have its stresses. But right to the end, the Queen could see and chose to see the good in Diana. And the death of Diana came as a ghastly shock. The Queen was told right away in the middle of the night, and her absolute priority straight away was the boys. History relates that the Queen was sort of slow to respond. She was not slow to respond. I mean, she was absolutely on it right away, and her priority was, right, we've got to make this as bearable for these poor traumatised boys as we possibly can. And that meant sort of throwing the warm embrace of Balmoral, of the family, around them. I mean, she went straight into grandmother mode rather than straight into sovereign mode, if you like.
She was an exceptional and gifted human being. In good times and bad, she never lost her capacity to smile and laugh, nor to inspire others with her warmth and kindness. I admired and respected her for her energy and commitment to others, and especially for her devotion to her two boys.
At the same time, she was extremely aware of the fact that this was, you know, represented a major challenge for the monarchy, and it was a great family tragedy. There is this sort of perception, this rather, I think, misplaced media narrative that the sort of royal family were sort of asleep for most of the week after her death, and that somehow the sort of the Blair government had sort of come to their rescue and show them what to do. I mean, that is complete piffle. She was very much very involved, very keen to make sure that the sort of Diana spirit, character, was properly recognised and respected. And in fact, in the start of that week, it was the Spencer family themselves who were calling for a private funeral. They wanted to mourn Diana privately away from the cameras, and it was the monarchy led by the Queen saying, well, you know, the people's princess. I mean, as Tony Blair called her, I mean, the palace weren't calling her that, but they fully respected and understood that sentiment. That had to be, you know, the world had to be given the opportunity to pay their respects to Diana as well. I think there is, again, this idea that somehow Diana's death was a sort of electric cattle prod that suddenly turned this sort of Victorian institution into a modern institution. And that, again, that's a complete misreading. I mean, the monarchy had been going through very, very fundamental internal reforms, probably the most extensive internal reforms in hundreds of years, through the late 80s and into the early 90s in terms of sort of management system structure. It had become much more meritocratic. It was changing the way it did things. It had changed the royal finances completely. Certainly there was a sort of a greater openness to doing things differently. That was very much a Diana legacy, if you like. She certainly made it easier for the more modernising progressive voices in the palace to be heard.
Robert Hardman's biography of Her Majesty is called Queen of Our Times and is out now. Richard Kay, coming to you, Robert there arguing that Diana didn't modernise the royal family as much as is sometimes thought and reported, but her death did definitely seem to change a lot in the public perception towards the royals.
I think not only did her death change royal attitudes and our attitude to the royal family, but her entire involvement with the royal family. And until Diana came along in 1980, the royals were ossifying. I mean, there was no huge interest in what was seen as a rather stuffy, remote family, did their job diligently, but there was no razzmatazz about them. Diana changed that, for better or for worse, depending on your point of view. I think for better. I think she brought some fantastic new understanding and nuance to what royalty can be about. And her life, and a very short life, was remarkable in many ways. And it did transform the appeal of the royal family across the globe.
I mean, I certainly remember as a small child seeing her, you know, dancing to Duran Duran and things like that was just something we had never seen the likes of before. And it's those images that really permeate with me. But you probably knew Diana better than most journalists, or if any. And what do you think that she made of the way the family did things when she entered the family?
Well, she found it frustrating. She found the restrictions imposed upon her difficult to work within, because the argument was always, well, this is the way we've always done it. And Diana had a very fresh approach. Well, why? Why can't we try this? Why can't we do that? And over the years, as we saw, she took on interests which were very different from the kind of things the royal family had been involved in. But it was all part of public service. I mean, a lot of people suggested that Diana wanted to sort of blow up the monarchy and overthrow it. That was absolutely not the case at all. She was the mother of the future king, and she viewed that position with great reverence, and she saw her role as a very important one in preparing William and indeed Harry for their future roles as very senior royals. And so all she wanted to do was to change it. She saw that the royal family was slightly out of step with changing fashions and changing times. And perhaps because she was a girl of the 60s and the 70s, she was able to bring a youthful element to monarchy.
Do you think that this idea in fictions like The Crown and other shows like that, there just seems to be this dichotomy between, you know, her wanting to change everything and there being nothing but resistance and anger about it from the establishment? Do you think that's a true representation?
The Crown's not a true representation. I mean, it's great fiction, it's great fun, and it's beautifully shot, beautifully made, and it looks really good. But it's not a documentary. Mm. It's a story. But there is no doubt that along the way, Diana was rebuffed. Obstacles were thrown in her way, particularly after her separation. It was much more difficult for her to do what she wanted to do. But by and large, don't get too confused with the idea that the monarchy is the way the Crown perceived it.
Now, Richard Eden what is certain is that, I mean, even if the family, the royal family, was changing anyway, Diana's introduction to the family accelerated that, didn't it?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I don't want to too much get into the debate between my esteemed colleagues Robert and Richard over Diana's influence.
You don't want to pick a side.
But what's fascinated me is how her sons have tried to sort of take on her legacy for themselves. And we've seen repeatedly how Harry has cited his mother and seems to be wanting to sort of take her legacy as sort of the rebel or the one who would do things differently and own that himself. And we've seen some resistance to that from William. And yeah. I think we're going to hear a lot more in Harry's memoirs, obviously about his relationship with his mother, but about how he is the sort of keeper of the flame type thing.
It's interesting that, because do you see William taking on the mantle of Diana's influence in that way of, like, I'm going to do things my way?
Well, I think what I've learned from watching them over the last few years in particular is that they are both representative of their mother, but they've taken different strands of her life. Harry has gone for the willful Diana, and William has gone for the more dutiful one. And those were the aspects to her character. She could do both, and she could do both brilliantly and dangerously and disastrously, as we know. But she was a very complex character, and it seems to me that the boys, or we shouldn't call them boys anymore, they're middle-aged men, but they've inherited different aspects of their mother's character.
The boy prince is a middle-aged man. That's the most depressing note to end on. Thank you. I feel very old now, but that is all we have time for on the programme this week. My thanks to Richard Kay, Richard Eden, Robert Hardman, and to you for watching. To play you out this week, some of the most memorable pictures from the life of the late Diana, Princess of Wales. See you next week. Bye-bye.